This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Jeff Adler, speaking today with Thomas Metzinger. Thomas Metzinger is Professor Emeritus of Theoretical Philosophy at the Johannes Gutenberg University of Mainz, Germany. In 2022, he was elected into the German National Academy of Science. We're speaking today about Thomas's new book, The Elephant and the Blind, The Experience of Pure Consciousness, Philosophy, Science, and 500-plus Experiential Reports, published by MIT Press on February 6, 2024, with an open-access PDF version available on the web now. In 2019, Thomas founded the Minimal Phenomenal Experience Project, an interdisciplinary research group dedicated to determining the essential, universal, minimal components of consciousness. In his new book, Thomas offers a hypothesis about what that minimal experience is, pure awareness. Drawing on over 500 experiential reports from meditators across the globe, he describes a state of awareness that is selfless, timeless, placeless, and perhaps the purest essence of consciousness. Mr. Metzinger, thank you for joining me today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Great. So let's just start with this. Why did you write this book? You say a few times in the text that this is not a scholarly text. So what is it?
Well, I'm trying to inspire many different people, the very different kinds of people. There's a little bit for philosophers and cognitive scientists like myself, but there for instance, for practitioners of meditation, there are some excerpts and quotations from classical texts, but everything not going very deep. And from our first psychometric study, there are these phenomenological reports where we had more than 3,000 people from 57 countries in the world to meditate. And we basically asked them, can you experience awareness as such? So not the consciousness of blue or green or something like that, but the consciousness of it all. Does this have a quality you can describe? And for people who are just interested in the phenomenology, for instance, they can just read these reports. So different people can do different things. But actually, I'm, so to speak, I'm preparing a door for other people to walk through. So I'm preparing a research project because I've been in consciousness research for many years. I'm one of the guys who founded the Association for the Scientific Study of Consciousness, past president, and there's a type of scientific explanation that hasn't been tried yet, and that's called a minimal model explanation. It's very simple to explain. You just try to subtract anything from the target phenomenon that you think is not necessary. And so the question is, what is actually the simplest form of conscious experience that we know? I have no answer to this. Our future is open, but I think the prime candidate to good entry point to start. That's the experience of pure awareness and meditation.
Great. So let's go with this idea that we have this research project of figuring out the minimal component of consciousness. As you just said, you're not tied to the idea that it's pure awareness, but you think that's the best guess, the best starting point. So I would just push you and ask, why do you suspect that pure awareness is the best place to start as an initial hypothesis of what the minimal form of consciousness is?
So let me give you two answers to this. One is more personal. I'm someone who has meditated at least twice a day for 47 years myself, so I'm a long-term practitioner. The other thing is in earlier research where we try to recreate out-of-body experiences with virtual reality. There's an English book called The Ego Tunnel about this, which should be accessible. We have asked the question, what is the simplest form of selfhood? So what's the simplest form of the me feeling, the selfie feeling? And done a lot of research about this. And then it was quite natural to ask, could one even subtract that? Could there be a form, kinds of states which are definitely non-selfie, but still count as states of conscious experience? And it grew out of this. So it's like from MPS to MPE, from minimal phenomenal selfhood to minimal phenomenal experience. That's the progression. That's where it came from.
So if minimal consciousness is a complete lack of self, what are we talking about when we talk about consciousness?
So I think, I mean, of course, I have a more complex computational story to tell about this. I think there could be formal models of this. It's a model of something, and it's a prediction of something in the brain, and that's something I call epistemic openness. So the experience that something can and will very likely be known. And before this gets too mysterious, I'll just give you two examples. I think everybody knows this. Everybody knows this. So one example is when you have had a good night's sleep and you, the very first 200 milliseconds of waking up, you are typically not oriented, as a psychiatrist would say, oriented to space, oriented to time, oriented to person. You do not yet know who you were yesterday. You don't know where you are and what time it is. Usually after a second or so, the system boots up, the brain activates itself, and you know. But that small period where you are wide awake, but there's no content. The bedroom isn't yet there. You don't really feel your body. Just this bare wakefulness. That is very close to it. And I would term this the brain's model of epistemic openness. It's a state that says this system can now know something, and very likely it will know something. I'll give another example. Imagine you have woken up completely and you haven't made two mistakes. You haven't touched your smartphone and you haven't talked to anybody. And you just go out to the terrace with your first cup of coffee maybe and sit there on a chair. And it's one of these nights where you have slept perfectly well. So you just sit there on the balcony or on a terrace and listen to the birds singing, and you're wide awake and really well rested. And then there's a thought arising. And 2 seconds later, a second thought arises. And between these two thoughts, there's a gap. Everybody knows it. That's it. That's also it, you know? So first thing, I think one can say it has very much to do with the experience of wakefulness. And as a matter of fact, classical Tibetan Buddhist sources, for instance, say exactly that. They say things like, primordial self-knowing wakefulness and stuff like that.
That's a good transition into my next question, which is, okay, so everyone has experienced the state of pure awareness, whether it's right after you wake up, whether you got a good night's sleep, you have not touched your phone yet, so forth. But people who have reached this state through frequent meditation, what do their reports tell us about it that we wouldn't know just from thinking about those little moments that come in between thoughts that you just mentioned?
But first, in your question, you see there's something interesting. If it's really true that basically every healthy person knows that, there seem to be a large majority of people who never thought this was important or interesting because nobody ever told them this could be interesting. And then there seems, in the tradition of humankind, in the spiritual tradition, there seems to be a small minority that cultivates these states through meditation techniques and other things, maybe also psychoactive substances and stuff like that. Why do they think it's important? They think that in principle it's about the only type of experience we know that's free of suffering, that doesn't have a certain element of craving and futility in it. So you see these people very often have theories about why this is valuable. So these theories might very strongly color the reports we get. But on the other hand, these people are, of course, experts because they've done this for hundreds, sometimes thousands of hours. And they say things like the most frequent descriptor is relaxation. The most simple description I have in all of our database is okayness. Then the next very obvious descriptors are silence, an experience of mental silence, no thoughts, clarity, a highly over average sense of being clear, really clear headed. And then it goes on, you know, then there are more interesting descriptions like existential ease, something that goes beyond just being relaxed or having no worry, a sense of non-identification with this tragic narrative. But then you get also one thing I liked about this, and you see this in the book, is that our meditators from so many different countries coined new metaphors apart from the description. They came up with new ideas. And one was, in German, it's called sensationsloses Staunen, which roughly translates as non-sensational awe. So people have an experience of awe and of surprise, but not in any dramatic way, you know, no fireworks or anything, silent awe. And then it's very interesting to see how different people describe this with very different kinds of words. So then people will say, if you look closely, this is nothing. If you look really closely, it has nothing to do with me, you know, and in the end, if you go to the later chapters of the book, you discover interesting details. For instance, people say it knows itself. It's not you knowing yourself, like egoic self-consciousness, but awareness has a reflexive element in it, which isn't personal. It's not you knowing yourself. This knows itself all the time already. And of course, maybe you ask me another question, because now I could go on and tell you about all these descriptions. Some people talk about ego dissolution, of losing the sense of self altogether. Other people speak of body dissolution, and so on.
That is where I was going, actually. So you've hinted at it so far, but in the book, you make a point that it seems like this pure awareness state is the closest thing to what many people in different meditative traditions, like you listen to Sam Harris's podcast or many different meditators, they call non-dual awareness, and that there's, you know, this pure awareness helps or is the breakdown between the separation of subject and object, of person in some reality. So can you go more into depth to this idea of how pure awareness breaks down reality in this sense?
Okay, one has to be very careful because we are living in a very special time. You know, we have all these self-proclaimed teachers on YouTube, and we have all these self-marketing pseudo-spiritual people in the media, and there's a lot of gossip and superficial talk. So the classical definition of non-dual awareness says that the difference between subject and object is not represented anymore, which has two components. There is no knowing self, so you as the meditator have ceased to be in a certain way, but also there is no reified, no objectified external reality. External reality may take on a virtual character, something that is not fully mind independent anymore. But if one looks at this closer, one has to distinguish at least two kinds of things. One, non-dual awareness in a full absorption episode. So in the rather rare situation where somebody sits on their cushion and they do something which is researchers call dual mindfulness practice, say. So they still try to observe their breath or their emotions and their feelings. There's somebody meditating. And then there's also something like non-dual mindfulness practice, which is absolutely effortless and has rather to do with recognizing a quality that is already there, but which you do not fabricate. You don't make this. It's more like discovering something that is there in all things. Now, imagine somebody who sits on a cushion and enters what we call a full absorption episode. A full absorption episode would be one where just the experiential quality of awareness per se is the only thing that can later be reported. So that not only are there no thoughts or so, but there was also no body there. It was just awareness itself. Again, this sounds dramatic and fancy. And I think the difficulty is just that it is actually very simple and natural. So a full absorption episode of somebody sitting on their meditation cushion, this would be non-dual because subject-object distinction vanishes. But then there's something else. And that is what most people mean when they talk about non-dual awareness, is when it's not a state, but a mode of experience in people who walk through the world, even with the whole kaleidoscope of sensory motor content changing all the time. And as this body moves through the world, the subject-object distinction is still suspended. That is something much rarer. That is something maybe sometimes have for seconds or minutes. And there are only a few people on the planet who have this on the order of hours or minutes, hours or days or something like that. That is what is generally meant, non-dual awareness as a way of living in a complete absence of a knowing self. And there's one very advanced Israeli meditator who described it, maybe that's intuitive for something. It's not me knowing, it's the world knowing. It's not me looking, it's the world looking. There seems to be a possible altered states of consciousness for human beings. And I think it's interesting because it ends all psychological suffering. That's, of course, the background. Yeah.
So you mentioned at the onset of your response to my question that there's a lot of gurus out there talking about non-dual awareness, and you have to sort of, just not buy into that stuff. But you're saying there is something that is non-dual awareness. And really seasoned practitioners can go minutes, if not an hour or so, with a complete absence of self. So you also, in the book, you make this point that you say, look, I could be wrong that this pure awareness thing is the minimal essence of consciousness. But you say, but there is something here that's interesting. There is something to be studied. So imagine I'm a curmudgeonly, skeptical
Very good,
philosopher. Yeah. I've never meditated. I've never taken psychotropics. I say, all this stuff you're talking about, these special meditators, got these minutes of non-dual awareness, I don't buy it. I think it's just a bunch of hippie hoo-hooey. So tell me why I'm wrong. Why should I care about this?
Well, you're not wrong. there is a nasty chapter in this book, namely chapter 17, that many of your, what did you say, woo-woo hippies will not like, because it talks about the two fundamental emotional needs every human being has. One is to deny their own mortality in a clever way. And I think, I mean, I've traveled a lot. I've been in India, Burma, in ashram monasteries. I've talked to meditators all my life. For many of them, it is clearly a strategy of mortality denial. So there is a longer narrative woven around this, the romanticism of being on a path or in a certain tradition. And there are, of course, taboo zones. So your philosopher, if he tries to talk to many of these people, will very soon realize that there are things that cannot be doubted or questioned for many practitioners, which is very different in a philosophy department.
Yeah.
You know, so there's often in the spiritual counterculture, which is very important, I think, and something we lack, there's a certain quality lacking that we call intellectual honesty, that is being really honest to oneself on a level of thought, you know, and, you know, as we say in German, not to lie into your own pocket, you know, and live by some creed. It's also interesting, your critical philosopher, which I am myself, will immediately realize is that many of these people like to call themselves spiritual but not religious. But if you look at this a little closer, they actually believe in quite a lot of things for which there is no empirical evidence or rational argument. And some researchers have asked, do we need a new concept, spiritual but not religious, to describe this cultural phenomenon, and come to the conclusion, no, this is private, experience-based religion. So I will now get even worse than your critical philosopher step by step. There is an old tradition in humankind, which is we create altered states, step one, and then we interpret them as we please. So we do drumming, rhythmic dancing, archaic techniques of ecstasy, you know, we take sacred mushrooms, psychoactive substances, we fast, we do sleep deprivation, we do silent meditation retreats. Then something happens. Our brains, which create virtual models of reality, which we later call our conscious experiences, create alternate models of reality. And we have them, we remember them, and then we interpret them as we please. And we say, I have seen that consciousness is independent from the physical brain. There is something that will not die. Or I have had a direct, indubitable insight into X. And then you get some story. So this is what human beings have been doing for millennia. And of course, a lot of the spiritual counterculture has this problem too. By the way, footnote, I found out, you know, there's this phenomenon, the psychedelic renaissance in America and in Europe. It's very different in America. In America, it's much more evangelical, hyper-capitalist style, you know, with large investors. And it just takes on this cult-like quality. It's not a real renaissance. So this is the background. But the more interesting question is, so human beings are capable of altered states of consciousness, and some human beings who are obviously not nuts claim that they have an epistemic potential. And that is where it gets philosophically interesting. Can there be forms of knowledge outside of language, beyond conceptual thought, maybe not graspable by the scientific method as we know it, but which are nevertheless absolutely relevant, deeply relevant from a philosophical perspective? And I have lived in the academic consciousness research community, and it's bizarre to see how many people there like to pontificate and make theories about consciousness and have almost no experience with these things in their private lives. They have never seriously meditated or tried more interesting psychoactive substances. And the suspicion is, of course, they are not really interested in the phenomenon. They are interested in making an academic career and getting tenure. Because if they were really interested in it, they wouldn't, you know, discuss and talk. They would just try everything, because you want to find, if you're, say, in philosophy of mind and you're specialized on consciousness and you're serious in epistemic gain, if you really want to know, you wouldn't ask long questions or so. If somebody tells you something like this, you would do it in your own life. And you might well come to the conclusion, yeah, it's me, it's not philosophically interested. I mean, I've now meditated for 5 years, and I've taken mushroom for 10 times, and that was very interesting, but it's philosophically irrelevant. That might be a real result. But what I find so strange is that so many academic consciousness researchers have so little interest in this. And of course, it is easy, say, to pick on some monk or some non-academic spiritual teacher, on some hippie who has taken a lot of certain things, and then show that they're contradicting themselves and this is all conceptually confused. That's cheap, you know? Everybody can do that. There's a lack of respect there. And all I'm trying to show in this book is that there's really a there. I don't know what it is, but there's something there. And I think it's quite relevant also from a very hardcore neuroscience perspective, for instance.
Thank you. That was a perfect transition into my next question, which is, so far, we've discussed why the phenomenon is interesting, what practitioners have said, but because you have a very interdisciplinary focus, you think that there should be a hard scientific study of consciousness. This isn't only about ending your own personal suffering. So let's pivot more into that. Where do you think this book can inform, you know, hardcore mind consciousness researchers?
Well, we have at the very end, we have a simplified predictive processing model of what it could be. Very soon, there's going to be a prize for the best mathematical model for the phenomenology of pure awareness. So there are some detailed scientific issues here, which are maybe not so interesting, but I'm trying to tease people at several locations in the book. So one teaser is, for instance, consciousness is not a subjective phenomenon.
So
then everybody, you know, the standard politically correct reaction is, no, my subjectivity is irreducible and I will not allow science to colonize my inner world. And but then there are very clearly conscious experiences, as we have shown, which are only subjective in a weak sense. So they are subjective, of course, in the sense that they happen in the brain of one single biological organism, or that, you know, one person reports about them afterwards. But why do they occur? Subjectivity and objectivity are not represented in the phenomenology. And I think the phenomenological notion of subjectivity is actually the core and the deepest meaning of it all. So if subjectivity does not belong in that sense to the essential features of consciousness, that's interesting, because at the same time, it shows that something like non-centered, non-egoic conscious experience is possible, what all the spiritual traditions have talked about for centuries. But at the other on the other hand, it shows that the phenomenon is wide open to hard scientific research, because it is not essentially tied to a first-person perspective, because it is not, as dozens of my colleagues have tried to show, irreducibly subjective in a certain sense. You know, that would be technical questions, of course, again, but that it is just not true that there is something that cannot be captured by science. Because in its origins, in its base layer, if you want to put it like that, it's not a subjective phenomenon. I have, if I may, am I talking too much, or can
no? Go
I,
for it. Go for it. Go for it. Please, go on.
So, I think there's a convergence zone with many low-hanging fruit, which is now finally coming out, and that's the convergence between philosophy, neuroscience, cognitive science, and spiritual practice—a serious spiritual practice—and I think there's an interesting common ground. And I have in the book, there's one example that tries to show a parallel. So we have, imagine the following. You are a neuroscientist that doesn't belong in any woo-woo nonsense meditation crap, in all this, you know, ideological stuff. But you're a lucid dreamer. You're a stable lucid dreamer. So you become lucid in a dream at night. And then you stand in your lucid dream and say, wow, I know all of this is just my brain. I know I am actually walking around in myself right now in this lucid dream. I know all this isn't true. It's a model of reality that this dreaming body in bed produces. And I know that I'm dreaming. In a certain way, I'm walking around in myself. Now, if you look at some of our more advanced practitioners, I have two or three reports in the book, they say literally the same thing if they describe non-dual awareness, as you have just asked at the beginning of our conversation. If you ask them, how is it to be in non-dual awareness as a stable state? They say, in a sense, it's like I'm walking around in myself. You know, I'm this wide open, non-centered space of knowing, and there is this little person walking around, going about its life in there. And this, there's a very striking structural similarity there. Actually, some advanced, I think, meditation experiences may describe things about the brain's model of reality that are actually there. That are much more close to the scientific worldview, if you will. So there is a convergence there, actually.
So it's precisely these, what we could just describe as fanatical, spiritual, out there people who are actually the closest to the scientific truth of it. Interesting.
Yeah, there's also fanatical out there scientific careerism. You know?
Oh, yeah, sure.
There's a mirror image.
I wanted to ask, though, so you mentioned your book. You have a sentence that says something like, we're sleepwalking into the age of AI. And it very much feels like that. obviously with LLMs, ChatGPT, and all these new AI tools, and everyone's debating all these different ethical questions, what their use are. But at a more basic level, I mean, we can go into the ethical questions if you want. We can go into criticisms of current AI technology. That's all fine. But I wanted to ask, kind of zooming out a little bit from this very current 2024 debate, I wanted to ask, how do you think this idea that consciousness is not fundamentally a subjective phenomenon, it's an objective phenomenon, how could that, or should that, inform our development of artificial intelligence in any way?
Well, so now I should tell you a little more about myself, actually. So there's another Thomas. So when I took my PhD in 1985, and I was allowed to teach my first seminar ever in 1987 in the Frankfurt Philosophy Department, it was called Artificial Intelligence and Philosophy. And from 2018 to 2020, I have served in the European Commission's High-Level Expert Commission on Artificial Intelligence, preparing that what you now know as the AI Act. So we prepared the ethics guidelines for trustworthy AI and the investment and policy recommendations for the European Union. So I have followed this a bit. And even normal people now begin to realize that this may really get out of hand in a number of ways. There are not just only multimodal generative models, but there will soon be generative agents roaming the net. And there are billionaires behind it who do not care about, you know, capital investors, high-risk investors in California, who do not care about future risk. We just want, you know, money to come back quickly. You have thousands of very smart young people in well-educated countries, in rich countries, who are jumping on this, very clever young people. And I think it's in the air that it might get faster than we expected it, and that we may actually lose control. One aspect is that even if the major tech companies in the US would actually be careful now because they're seeing the risks, there are all kinds of other actors, non-state actors, secret service, terrorist groups, following on their heels with about 6 to 9 months delay. So if OpenAI puts out GPT-5, there are other much less controlled actors on the planet who will have this within less than a year. So it's a really critical situation. And now, one more information, and then I'll tell you why there's a completely unexpected and highly sensitive link between the pure awareness research I'm trying to prepare and the question of machine consciousness or synthetic phenomenology. I have, 3 years ago, I've published a paper, it's open access, demanding a moratorium on synthetic phenomenology until 2050. So where I've basically said we shouldn't even go near artificial consciousness, that's very different from artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't even risk the creation of artificial phenomenal states unless we really know what we're doing. And not for egotistic reasons like Nick Bostrom style intelligence explosion and we're going to lose control, but because we might create artificial suffering in a very large number of virtual entities, and that we should be, on ethical grounds, not take these risks before we fully understand them. And that being said, imagine we would have computational functionalism is true. We don't know this, but imagine we have fine-grained or sufficiently fine-grained mathematical models of the simplest form of consciousness, as I've researched it in this book. It's a very close step for somebody to implement this in a machine. Now, I think creating a machine that has nothing and nothing else but the selfless experience of pure primordial wakefulness. There's nothing unethical in that, because you don't create suffering in any way. But of course, greedy and egotistic as human beings are, they will not stop there. So there's a very strange dialectic for me. On the one hand, I'm the first person on the planet who called for a moratorium there in this issue of artificial consciousness. On the other hand, the question, what are the most valuable and interesting states of consciousness, and looking into meditation, might in the end lead to exactly that. If it gets into the hands of irresponsible, greedy people. Because if what I think, and it might well be wrong, if a minimal model explanation of consciousness is possible, and we have one, then we can put that minimal model into a machine. So there's a completely unexpected link between what I'm advocating, namely looking at these ancient practices of cultivating pure awareness more carefully, and AI ethics. And the dedication of this book reflects it.
Absolutely. So I have to ask then, if you did arrive at a mathematical model of pure awareness that could be implemented on an AI system, but to your point, might lead greedy, non-human focused people to develop more than that, what would you do with that information? What would you do with that model?
I'm not very optimistic. In principle, we should just stop any kind of research that might lead to more, like the evolution of egoic self-awareness, which in my view is almost inevitable if the thing is coupled to an agent and begins to have something like a robot body or something, moves around in the world, or if it expands the predictive horizon of its self-model into the future. It is not just in the here and now, then you will pretty soon get something like an egoic knowing self. And we should avoid this by all costs. But I'll share an anecdote with you. When I was discussing with this high-level legal person in Brussels in Europe, and he was completely critical, the European Union, it didn't want to have, because it's very contaminated by industrial lobby, it didn't want to have certain things in the AI Act. One is autonomous lethal weapons. Nobody wanted, military applications of AI, but nothing like that is in the law. Somehow the industrial lobby made it disappear. Another thing was artificial consciousness. They said, come on, this is just science fiction, will never happen. And of course, it's just the industry that was afraid it might ruin their future markets if the public gets nervous about sentient AI or something like this. So this guy asked me, so what exactly is wrong with artificial consciousness? And I said, well, we might create a lot of suffering on non-biological carrier systems. And then he said, wait a minute, we punish and torture animals to make them do, we kill and eat animals to make them do what we want them to do. We punish our children. We inflict suffering on non-human animals and on humans. That's part of our normal cultural practice. If we could make these machines learn faster by making them suffer and punishing them, if that would make their learning curve steeper, that would be interesting. I don't know why this should be in principle wrong. Why should this be wrong in principle? We do it to humans. We do it to animals when we train them, when we domesticate them and stuff. And I just thought, yeah, I got you. So if we found a way of not only having, say, what a neuroscientist or some AI people might call negative reward prediction, like a negative valence in a system, but if we could make it really hurt really hurt, consciously experience pain and suffering. And it would lead to higher profits and better systems. I think human beings would do it. And that's the risk. That's the risk. And I think we really shouldn't. To just say it very simply, we shouldn't trigger a second layer of conscious evolution, including suffering above us, before we have understood the roots and causes of our own suffering, why we suffer so much. We should be very cautious there.
Well, there's an interesting parallel hearing you talk about this stuff. You know, one thing I loved about your book was that you sort of find this middle ground between, you know, there's super spiritual types who it's easy to dismiss on the grounds that they make up lots of stories, as you said. Then there's these super sort of stodgy philosophers who, as you said, they don't actually know meditation. They're so close-minded, they miss anything. And you find this, you know, healthy middle ground of there is to be studied here. And now we're talking about an AI and finding a similar sort of middle ground in which there's people who say, terminate all the craziest sci-fi movies, they're all coming true. And you say, okay, probably not. And then there's people who say, all AI is great, there's no fear. And you say, that also doesn't seem quite true. I quite appreciate your perspective of, no, there are real fears. And they might not look the way they did in sort of the sci-fi movies we're familiar with, but there are grand fears. And they emerge not from necessarily tyrannical actors from understanding, but just from natural human greed and, you know, willingness to put profits before care. So I would invite you, write another book, write about this subject, Thomas. It's really interesting stuff. I don't want to drag this out too much longer. So to end on a positive note, I wanted to ask, is there any particular report, metaphor, description from your book that you'd want to leave us with?
Oh, there's so many. I don't know, but I wouldn't want to pick an individual one. But if one leaves all the reports and all the science and philosophy aside, the simplest result of this first study is how many people are out there who actually experience such states on a daily basis even. And these people are not part of the cultural mainstream. This is not in the media. And I have a suspicion that many of the people who have gone a little deeper into all of this will very often choose not to speak about this at all. Because in a certain sense, it's not you who has this, owns this, or knows this. It is that which never speaks, as one of the longer reports in the book says. It's that part of you that will never select, never think, never judge, and it will never speak. And people who have merged with that from time to time, they will not speak, I think. And my suspicion is that there's actually a source of insight and wisdom in our societies in these crazy times that nobody realizes. Those people who are really modest, you know, and really silent, and who don't go on the internet to talk about all this. And they may become an interesting and very important resource in these critical times that are coming towards us.
Well, hopefully one of these elusive people is listening to this podcast and they hear your message. Thanks, Thomas. This is great. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.